law school, baby. It all starts here.
Caleb Parsons is 6'9 swingman. You can shoot the three.
This is why you don't teach lessons.
Exactly.
UF basketball fans are terrible and shameful. Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Friday, April 3rd, 2009. I am Adam Berry, the assistant sports editor and softball beat writer for Alligator Sports. And with me today are
Mike McCall, football beat writer and columnist.
Evan Drexler, sports editor and football beat writer.
Bobby Colobi, baseball beat writer.
All right, we got a lot to talk about here. We're going to talk about football spring practice, some of the SEC basketball coaching changes, and then a little bit about the Final Four and our brackets near the end. And we'll hand out our weekly Reggie Nelson Awards for Excellence in the Field of Sport and Kyle Jackson Bad Angles of the Week. But that's at the end of the show. We're going to get started here with some talk about football spring practice. We're going to talk a little bit at first about the top performers, maybe the people who've surprised you a little bit out there. McCall, start us off. Who's surprised you?
One of the names that's been kicked around the most is Adrian Bichel. He's a redshirt freshman cornerback, didn't play at all last year. He came in alongside Jeremy Brown, and I think good things were expected from both of them, but I think more so for Jeremy Brown. And Bichelle's been the standout so far in spring practice. He got some praise from Urban Meyer yesterday, even though it was a little bit of a backhanded compliment. Meyer said, you know, Coach Vance Bedford, the cornerback's coach, was a lot higher on him than me, but he's really been impressive so far, and he looks like he'll be able to compete. So that's going to be especially important with the news yesterday. Janoris Jenkins, one of the starting cornerbacks last year, had a great season, three interceptions. And he came out and said yesterday he's going to be playing the nickel cornerback position in the fall. It doesn't mean he's losing his starting job. He'll still be starting opposite Joe Hayden. But another corner is going to have to move in there when Jenkins moves to the nickel. And Jenkins said right now it's Wandy Pierre-Louis. You might want to avoid that if possible. So it's really important if Adrian Bichel can have a good spring and put himself in a position to take that over.
I don't see Janoris playing much time at nickel in the fall because they're going to want to get Will Hill on the field, and he played a lot of nickel last year. So I think right now they want to give him as much experience at safety. But with Ahmad Black and Major Wright and Dorian Monroe, they got plenty of safeties. Oh, and who just got in?
Dee Finley.
Yeah, Dee Finley just got here too. So they got plenty of safety. So they're going to want to get Will Hill on the field as much as possible. And I see him going in at that nickel again, and JJ's going to be fine in the corner.
So why do you think they're trying that out then?
Well, like you just said, to kind of let Will Hill work more at safety during the spring. Let him focus on that. The thing with me with the safeties, I'd like to know what you guys think about this. I would have a really hard time disrupting the starting four from last year with Jenkins and Hayden at corner and Wright and Black at safety. Even though I still think Major Wright should be playing strong safety, not free safety, and Ahmad Black is more of like a nickel type player even than a free safety or a strong safety to me.
I mean, Ahmad Black never played safety until last year, so he was always a cornerback, so he definitely fits in nicely. I agree, Major Wright needs to be playing strong safety. He doesn't have the range as Will Hill, but the problem is Ahmad Black is not a free safety either. So if you're going to keep those two back there, you got to keep Major Wright free safety. So until Urban Meyer decides that Will Hill needs to be playing safety, Major's going to be a free safety still.
I really don't think you need to mess with anything at all. I mean, why change what works? They destroyed Oklahoma on deep balls last year in the national championship game with the two safeties playing the positions they're playing now, and the cornerbacks did a solid job, some serious hits, great interceptions. I don't know, all season long it seemed like they were in an adjusting period as what Urban Meyer was saying. Oh, we're still adjusting to these changes, you know. He's not a natural safety, meaning Ahmad Black. But it seemed like in the end, it worked out. He did a solid job all year. There was really no reason, I think, to change it.
I agree that they shouldn't change it. But if he's not getting Will Hill playtime at the nickel, I think he should, because Will Hill, I think, is much more talented than Ahmad Black. And I don't like rotating safeties, because one of the most important thing in the secondary is communication and knowing where someone's going to be. And if you start changing that around, a lot of times there's going to be miscommunications. There's going to be a deep ball that gets by them just because they didn't know where the other guy's going
to
be.
The nickel should almost go to like the best player outside of the starting four in the secondary, and that's got to be Will Hill.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really wouldn't break up that four, though. I mean, no. You could see it alone on the play near the goal line against Oklahoma last year, the tip ball interception.
Mm-hmm.
That set it all right there. And like the plays they all made, Ahmad Black with the diving interception, Major Wright crushing Manuel Johnson. I mean, that's all what they like made their name on, and maybe they're not all perfect fits for where they are, but the way they play together is really important.
One name we haven't talked about is, where do we think Dorian Monroe fits into this whole situation?
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. I mean, I like Dorian Monroe a lot as a as from what I've dealt with him interviewing and everything, I like him. I think he's a really nice guy. And I think he's a good player, but, I mean, you're at Florida. There's a lot of good players here. And if you can't get on the field, I mean, there's no sympathy. But one of the bright sides to this, when you have all this talent in the secondary and guys aren't all going to get on the field, they're going to be playing special teams. And Florida's going to have one of the best special teams units. We were sitting out there at practice the other day watching them, you know, do kickoff return and kick coverage and just pointing at everybody going, he was a four-star recruit, he was a four-star recruit, he was a five-star recruit. Like, it's ridiculous the talent they're going to have on special teams.
I mean, with Dorian Monroe and also with just the depth they have at safety, what's important is that if Major Wright slips up, if Ahmad Black slips up, you know Dorian Monroe, Will Hill, and Dee Finley all just waiting for that, take their chance and take over. I mean, none of them are Kyle Jackson bad, but if any of them start performing anywhere near Kyle Jackson level, they're off the field. Like, there's not a question, do we have someone who's ready? They have plenty of people who's ready to step in, so you're going to believe that they're going to be even better because the competition is just raising them way better than they were last year.
So we saw, you know, Ahmad Black make this switch from corner to safety last season. Is there any chance we can see some of the extra safeties going from safety to corner? You know, you said you don't like Wandy a lot. Is there any chance Dorian Monroe can get some rotation in his corner or even the nickelback spot?
It's a much harder transition to go from safety to corner than corner to safety, in my opinion.
With the man coverage.
Because with man and... I mean, you got to be a little bit quicker also at cornerback than you do safety. I'm not sure if Dorian Monroe, especially after that knee surgery, can do that. Will Hill, he's someone that he's an exceptional talent. You probably can put him quarterback, wide receiver, running back, anywhere on the field, and he's going to be good because he's that type of talent. He did it in high school. He can do it now. But Ahmad Black, he used to play cornerback. He's someone that could make that move. But I don't think Dorian Monroe or Major Wright has the speed to move to cornerback.
I just think it's kind of sad what happened to Monroe. You know, he was coming into the beginning of last season as the number, you know, the other safety starter along with Major, and now he comes back a year later and his job is gone.
You got Trent Green.
Yes, his job is gone.
That's,
I mean,
very true.
His job is gone. I mean, he's got no top two spot on this team at all.
Yeah, I do feel bad for Dorian, but, I mean, like we said...
I mean, I understand the circumstances. I'm not, like, saying that it's unfair, but, like, it's kind of, just kind of sad for him.
But with all that talent like back there, I mean, it seems like the coaches are starting to realize what they've got going on in the secondary. I mean, we saw them running a 3-3 nickel in practice the other day. What did you think of that, Bob?
I like it because they're weak on the defensive line. They have a decent amount of players, but no one that I think is all that special of a talent. And they have some undersized defense tackle, which make good... three linemen, defensive end, and they have Omar Hunter, who's a big guy who can be that nose guard. And they have plenty of linebackers, so they can rotate three linebackers, and they got plenty of DBs. So it works. The only weird thing is that it's a very strange formation for them to be running in college. So it could give them an edge because offenses won't be seeing this very much, but it's going to be interesting to see how they actually do against an actual offense.
I mean, they're versatile enough to throw Will Hill in the box or Major Wright in the box to sort of make up for whatever disadvantages the 3-3-5 presents, right?
They'd be throwing a lot at offenses because they'd be sending blitzes from weird places. And then you still have Dunlop and Cunningham on the outside. That's pretty good. Those are two good defensive ends.
Cunningham might be a little too small for a three-lineman set because... he's all about getting around that corner. You put someone who's, what, 230, 240, in, like, right between a guard and a tackle, he's just going to get swallowed up every time. Cunningham kind of loses his position with that type of defense. But the main thing is that you have to remember the 3-3 nickel probably is only going to be run when they get ahead, and with their offense, they're going to be ahead. So that gives them the benefit of being able to play nickel because they're not too worried about the run anymore and they can blitz like crazy and they have their DBs to cover the passes.
And it's not like we're talking about huge problems here. We're talking about, you know, too many people. It's always a good thing to have too many people, you know. They'd rather have six safeties you can play than, you know, two or one like they had at the beginning of last season. But as far as the size on the line, how do we feel about Earl Okine coming in next year to kind of switch it up a little bit? I mean, he's huge. He's Dunlap size. I mean, he's
yeah,
a big guy.
And now he's moving inside a defensive tackle, too, which is really interesting. It's gonna be cool to see how that works out.
Dunlap and Okine, perfect DNs in a three-lineman set.
Yes, that's
so
where I was going with that.
They do fit that, you know, that mold really well. But Okine, I mean, they seem to like him. They like the fact they put on all this weight. So
he is huge.
He'll probably see the field. I mean, they have a very weak inside with the loss of Torrey Davis and John Brown. I mean, they didn't do too much last year. I mean, Torrey Davis had the big stops in the championship game, but besides that, they weren't doing too much. But when you lose depth at defensive tackle, it really hurts you. So they need as many people to play inside as possible.
All right, we got all that out of asking who do we think is going to be the top performers. Let's move on and see where this next question takes us. Who do we think needs to step up out there?
Well, like what Bob was just saying, if you had Okine and Dunlop on the outside, you got to have somebody to hold down the forward inside. And Omar Hunter was the guy who came in last year as a freshman with a ton of hype. Urban Meyer himself did most of the hyping for Omar Hunter, and then he didn't do anything when he got here. Now, yesterday he said he's shed 25 pounds. Mostly by eating chicken a lot. He's at 305. He said he's healthy for the first time since he got here. And, I mean, he doesn't have as much pressure on him now as he did coming in as a freshman, but he needs to really step up now, especially if they want to run something like the 3-3 nickel.
Omar Hunter is the perfect reason why I have my theory about I don't want to recruit big, fat defensive tackles, because they've always been in the trenches against high school offensive linemen, which can go from 260 to like 180. I played guard for a little bit. It was ugly when I had to go up against a 300 pounder. Like, he can easily manhandle anyone. Whereas Earl Okine, who is a smaller guy in high school, had to work hard, was quick. Now you put some weight on him really easily. He's now a really quick defensive tackle who's got the weight. I prefer going that way instead of a Moore Hunter who's kind of turned into a project, because you have to get him in shape, you have to get him faster, you got to get him working harder. So I'd rather go with the smaller guy who you can put weight on than the fat guy who you have to take weight off.
Yeah, that's interesting, especially with as much as Urban Meyer covets speed. You know, I mean, an Earl Okine guy fits that perfectly. You bring in a big, fast guy and make him even bigger, and then as opposed to bringing in... I mean, it's not like Omar Hunter's slow. He was still pretty quick for a big guy. That was one of his main things, but I agree with what you're saying.
And like Joe Cohen, just a little while ago, he was recruited as a running back and ended up playing defensive tackle. I mean, the speed he brought to the line was just so incredible that he was so hard to block, because he was quicker than every lineman that was out there.
All right, who else do we feel needs to step up? Do we have anybody else specifically here?
I got Emmanuel Moody, especially if they're going to run the I formation, which I'm not a big fan of them running. But if they're running the I, Emmanuel Moody's probably the only back they've got that can be an I formation back. So he needs to step up.
Yeah, I talked to Moody about that yesterday. He said he's really excited about getting into that, but... I mean, like Urban Meyer said earlier this week, it doesn't look like the I form is going to last very long here. I mean, that came in with Steve Adazio as he's taking over as offensive coordinator. He's more of an old school type guy. But they don't have the tight ends and they don't have the fullbacks to run it. So that's going to be a big problem. And I don't know if that'll last. But like Moody was saying, I mean, it's just they have to have some level of confidence in Moody if they're going to go to an I form or anything under center like that. Because he would be like the main factor in that kind of thing.
And they showed no confidence in him last year at all. Yeah,
that's true.
I find it kind of funny, though, that Urban Meyer says he has no fullbacks, when last year he made it a point to recruit a fullback, and he got TJ Pridemore to come in and be the fullback, when then last year he just said, all right, we don't need a fullback anymore. And now they bring in a fullback, and say, well, we don't got one, when he made it a point to recruit one. So it's kind of funny that he's saying that they don't have one.
The other big problem is Dez Parks has looked pretty bad so far in spring practice. Urban Meyer said the other day that he can't tell right from left.
That was a quote of the day from Urban.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him get blown up a couple times, especially by D. Finley. There was one time where he was running across the middle of the field. Finley didn't even hit him hard. He didn't even lean into him. He just standing up, ran into him, hit him with his arms, and Dez Parks went flying. That's just not a good sign. It looks like he's a little overwhelmed right now.
I really enjoyed following his development through the stories. I haven't been at practice, but I feel like Dez Parks is just like a lost kid out there, judging by the articles I'm reading out there. He's just getting blown up.
I mean, the defense is absolutely dominating so far, and that's not uncommon at all. I mean, Urban's saying like the defense is usually ahead. And defense, it's pretty simple. You know, you tackle, you hit the hole, you cover a guy. I mean, sure, there's terms, there's blitzes, but at this point, they're not really going into it. Offense, you got completely new terminology, different ways to block, different ways to run route. Everything's brand new for a lot of these guys, and I mean, and your timing's completely off, especially with all these new offensive linemen. They're not going to be hitting the hole at the same time, so it takes a really long time to develop an offense, whereas a defense, you take 1-2 days, and you can have a defense that's ready to play.
I got one more. James Wilson is another guy that's been mentioned by the coaches a lot. They're a little thin on the offensive line with losing those three seniors. James is going to have to step up. James is my boy, and I think he's going to be great. And it's really important to remember, offensive linemen take a while to develop. James still has three more seasons, and he's a very talented offensive lineman. I think he's going to be great. I think he's going to do really well here. For this season, he said he's working at both guard positions, left and right guard, and they filled the right tackle position. They said they got to start. Was it Marcus Gilbert?
I believe it was Gilbert.
Yeah, so they've got that set, and then when the Pouncies are both healthy, Marquise is in right now, but Mike's out. He'll be playing at guard. And then if you can keep James in there, and then who's left tackle?
Carl Johnson.
Carl Johnson.
But also, Matt Patchen is someone they want to actually play some tackle. And the most talented offensive line recruit is Xavier Nixon, who's not here yet. I think he's a little undersized yet to play, but he can also provide depth if they need it.
Say one thing about Matt Patchen. We saw him the other day walking out to practice. He looks like he's lost a lot of weight. He's still on crutches, has his knee wrapped and everything, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens with him this year. There was some talk about him playing a little bit of tight end.
I remember that.
Which I could see with the way he looked when he was at practice the other day, unless he throws a lot of weight on. I know he's really, really specific about his diet, so it might be he weighs his food and things like that. He's really into it.
He could have had mono again. That happened to him after his senior year in high school. He had mono and lost like 20, 30 pounds and went from a 260 offensive lineman to a 230, which he's probably struggled to put back on. And if he got mono again, he just drops right
off. That's purely speculation, by the way.
That is speculation.
No coverage that the Matt Patchen has mono.
If you lose a lot of weight, especially when you're supposed to be playing offensive line in college, there's probably something wrong.
Yeah, so basically a lot of the offensive line not named Pouncey is a question mark right now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of shifting around the offensive line all the time, and we'll see in August where they are.
All right, speaking of shifting on the offense, I want to talk a little bit about the receivers here. We've talked about them before, but McCall, tell us what Meyer was saying about them after practice.
Yeah, Urban Meyer was very unhappy with his receivers yesterday after practice. I mean, he kind of bashed the running backs too a little bit. It's important to note that in both cases, at the end of bashing them, he said, "Oh, well, they're good, and they'll get better. We're just not there yet." But what he said about the receivers was...
That's a phrase Urban Meyer uses a lot. They're just not there yet, by the way.
Yeah, but so he said he wasn't happy with the receivers when he was pressed on it. He said, "Well, they're just not getting open." And it's this really unique way of looking at football, where if you can't get open, if you're covered by the DB, you can't complete a pass. And I don't think our guys understand that right now. Maybe we haven't done a good job of teaching them that. So you can tell he's really frustrated and fed up with... But you got to think, too, like what Bob was saying, the defense is dominating. You get the top 22 players coming back on defense. You're losing three or four your best receivers, which Meyer pointed out also. I mean, they're not going to look great in the spring, but they do have a long way to go, and they're going to have to get better for this team to succeed.
Yeah, I was just going to make the same point before you did, is that they're going against the top 22 returning defensive guys. And, you know, I'm sure these receivers will have no problems getting open against Charleston Southern in the first week of the regular season. So, you know, it's just a completely different issue when they're playing against the Gators defense.
They'll probably be all right.
The big thing with the wide receivers is that they're not going to be like last year. You're not going to have Lewis Murphy, and you're not going to have Percy Harvin. That's not how they're going to have to do it. They're going to be more like 2006, where they had, you know, they had Bubba Caldwell, they had Dallas Baker, and they had Jermell Cornelius. So you're going to look for David Nelson to be, maybe even Carl Moore, probably David Nelson's leading the way here as that Dallas Baker type guy, whereas Deontay Thompson fits the mold of Bubba Caldwell. Then you have DeBose, who is going to be like Percy as a freshman, where he's on the field kind of a lot, probably about 50% of the snaps, and gets a couple carries. He'll start run the ball more towards the end of the season, and he's involved, but he's on the field as a threat, which is the main point. And Jermell Cornelius is a couple guys stepping up. I mean, I don't know if you're going to have a Cornelius type guy, but you're going to have a third receiver who needs to have that type of role where it's just another guy to throw to, and that could be Justin Williams or it could be Riley Cooper.
And that I was just going to say that is, remember, Riley Cooper's not out there practicing with the football team because he's still with baseball for now. So there's one receiver that they're missing who has some experience with getting open.
Riley Cooper could be the Riley Cooper of 2006, where you're like, "Hey, who's that random white guy who just caught the pass?" And they're like, "Oh, it's Riley Cooper."
Who's that just blew someone up on a kickoff return?
Yeah, that's Riley Cooper. Riley Cooper's become quite a downfield blocker, I've got to say. He's been doing a very good job of that.
Oh, and I can't let this go. I want to see what you guys think about this. Meyer dropped this gem yesterday that he thinks Riley Cooper could be a high-round pick in the NFL. What's your take on that?
He doesn't touch the ball enough for me to really gauge his NFL, you know, stock. Like I just said, I think one of his best assets is his downfield blocking lately. I mean, he can catch. There's no doubt he can catch. But I don't know. He's going to have to touch the ball a lot more for him to merit a first-day NFL draft pick like Meyer would have suggested.
I agree. He's definitely got to touch the ball more. Got to get, you know, into a spotlight. I mean, if you look at his size and his speed and you know, his toughness, he's a guy that teams would like to draft. But if he's never catching the ball in college, no one's going to know who Riley Cooper is, and no one's going to really care who Riley Cooper is. So unless, you know, Urban Meyer has a secret plan to make Riley Cooper the star receiver, it's not he's not going to be a high draft.
This isn't like the NBA draft where it's a lot on potential. You have to show your stuff in college.
And there's potential, but if they don't know who you are, you can only go so far.
Matt Jones. That was solely based on potential that he went in the first round.
No, but I mean he went on potential and workouts from from combines and pro day, but they had already known who he was because he was a very good quarterback who ran all over the place in the SEC. So teams knew who he was and said, we don't want him as a quarterback, but we want that type of athlete. Riley Cooper's not getting that type of attention.
He also just had experience being on the field and being a guy that a team could count on. What inspired Meyer to say that about Cooper, though?
He was just talking about how, when you've got three or four guys out, he's like four if you count Riley Cooper. He was talking about Cornelius Ingram, Percy Harvin, Lewis Murphy, those three being gone. And then if you count Riley Cooper not being there because he's at baseball,
okay.
He's like, and all those guys could be very successful in the NFL. He's like, even Cooper, I think he could be like a high-round pick.
All right, and where does DeBose factor into this? You mentioned him earlier as maybe being like the Harvin of this year's team, McCall.
Andre DeBose from Sanford Seminole High in Orlando. He's the number two wide receiver coming out of high school this year. He's coming to Florida. There's a lot of really high expectations on him. My column in The Alligator on Friday talks about this, and I think the expectations for him are getting a little out of hand. Some people expect that he's going to come in and just fill in for Percy Harvin because Meyer said several times he doesn't want to lose the Percy position. Wide receiver is a threat to do a lot of things in the offense because a lot of opposing teams told him last year that that's the hardest thing for them to defend, which everyone knew that already. But so he doesn't want to lose that. He's got to fill in for it somehow. And a lot of people seem to think that Andre DeBose can step in and do that. He's very talented. He's a great wide receiver. I mean, in high school, he took direct snaps. He played wide receiver. He played running back, returned kicks. I think he might have even played in the secondary a little bit. Really versatile athlete, but he's not the same as Percy Harvin. He's a different type of player. He's more the kind of guy that makes a cut and runs, just runs by you, where Percy Harvin was a little bit more shifty. I mean, he could run up the middle of the field, do all kinds of zigzagging, and get by people. DeBose isn't the same kind of player. He's more in the mold that Chris Rainey and Jeffrey Demps are, where they just kind of make a cut and blow by you. And so it's going to be a little different seeing what happens when he comes in. I just think the hype's getting really out of hand.
Like I said, he needs to be like Percy from freshman year, except now with Percy, his freshman year, people didn't know what to expect from that type of player. Now teams, if you put DeBose on the field and you say he's Percy, he's going to be like, all right, you got to watch what he's going to do. So just having him on the field puts a threat. Whether or not he actually does anything is besides the point earlier in the season. Once teams realizes what he can actually do, that's when they'll start actually treating him like Andre DeBose and not Percy Harvin. But one point that I actually made, and you used it in your column, I believe, was that he is this class's Tim Tebow. Percy didn't get he got to be undershadowed pretty much. He came in as probably the best talent in that class, but all the attention was on Tim Tebow. So he didn't have that pressure. DeBose is this class's Tim Tebow, and he's just got all the pressure in the world on him.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You've got a lot of pressure on DeBose to make things happen. And also, I mean, like you said, there's a mold now for DeBose to fit into. When Harvin got here, it was, well, we'll see what he does. We'll use him how we can. We'll get him the ball. But DeBose has to live up to something now.
All right, and does it help that, he's going to have, the Demps, the Rainey guys to maybe feel a little bit of Harvin
it helps
stuff
a lot.
In the backfield?
Like what David Nelson said to me last week was that it's going to take four or five guys to do it, and that's exactly right. It's going to take a while for DeBose to find his feet. I mean, I think you're talking middle of the season. You'll see flashes of his talent. He'll make a couple big plays, probably against the Patsies they play earlier in the year.
Patsies?
Yeah, but you won't see him really emerge and start doing things until, second half of the season. So Rainey and Demps and Deontay Thompson, those guys are going to have to fill in for that too.
I gotta say, it's gonna be more of a Deontay because the whole point of Percy's position is someone who's gonna attack you, down the field and run the ball. And they don't seem really dedicated for Chris Rainey or Jeff Demps to be, going out for passes too often. So you need someone who's that dual threat that just it's that unexpected aspect of the game where you don't know what he's gonna do. So I don't think Rainey and Demps can take the carries, but they can't be like. Have defenses wondering what are they going to do this time.
But I mean, it's just as hard if you have dangerous wide receivers outside and dangerous guys in the backfield where the wide receivers can take end arounds or they can go downfield, or Chris Rainey and Jeff Demps can run the option, they can take direct snaps. I mean, you can fill in for it. You're never going to get it in one package again. I mean, maybe DeBose will be that later on down the road. It's going to be really hard to duplicate what Harvin was able to do here.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, linebackers are told, run first, pass second. DBs, pass first, run second. Like, you're told certain things. So when you have wide receivers, you know that you're covering them for the passing game. When you got running backs, you know you're going to be trying to stop their run. When you have a guy who you don't know what he's going to do, you don't know whose responsibility is to cover him, so the entire team now has to pay attention to that one guy instead of just the DBs or just the linebacker. So it completely changes to just having one guy who can do both.
All right,
as well as Percy did.
Right. All right, I think that about wraps it up for our football talk here. That was some hard-hitting analysis there.
Good talk.
The hard-hitting analysis we're occasionally known for having here on the Alligator Sports Podcast. All right, and we're going to move on, talk a little bit about the changes in the SEC and the basketball world. Evan, you wrote a column about that. Tell us what it's all about. All
right, so basically, after the Billy Donovan is not going to Kentucky saga ended, the head coach at Memphis, John Calipari, decided he would be taking the Kentucky job. So he moved over from Conference USA domination every single year to Lexington. And also former UF assistant coach Anthony Grant, who was at Virginia Commonwealth, is now the head coach at Alabama. So two fairly big-name coaches coming into the SEC in the last week. And I wrote a column in Thursday's Alligator, which basically says this is trouble for the Gators because now they have to recruit against a coach in John Calipari and a coach in Anthony Grant who, you know, Calipari knows the area of Kentucky. He just moved over one state from Tennessee. And Anthony Grant was in Florida, so he knows the same people that Billy Donovan will be recruiting. I don't know, it's just two big names coming to the conference, and it can only hurt the Gators. It'll help the league as a whole. It'll make the league stronger because the league was a joke of a laughingstock last season. Only two teams made the NCAA tournament. And it'll be great for the league to have big-name coaches recruiting big-name players. But it will hurt UF because they're going to have more competition for recruits. And with Calipari coaching Kentucky, big competition in the division for winning titles every year.
Very upset that you insulted the SEC so badly and said only had two teams in. We had three. Thank you very much.
Well, come on. Mississippi State doesn't count. No one will remember that Mississippi State made the NCAA tournament in 5 years. Like they were a joke of a team and
there's
shouldn't have made it.
A lot of teams that people will forget made the tournament.
Okay, so there you go. That's even more.
They'll fall in the category.
That makes the conference even more of a laughingstock because I forgot to include Mississippi State in my mental tally of one, two teams made the tournament. So. Like I said, this coaching move could only help the SEC.
All right, but let's talk about how it hurts Florida, first of all. In terms of recruiting, what is this? You know, how is this going to affect Florida? And how is it going to make, Kentucky so much better?
I mean, John Calipari has that name recognition. He's at Kentucky, which is, doubly bad for Florida because now instead of competing against Billy Gillespie in Kentucky, they're going against a better coach. So more kids are going to be going to Kentucky. The good aspect of it is that you usually recruit kids that other schools in your conference recruit. So the kids that John Calipari are going to be talking to, Florida now are going to be, sending their scouts out there as well. So maybe it'll bring in a Memphis-like atmosphere to, or Memphis-like players to Florida now.
The biggest positive in this to me is that Billy Gillespie is gone and I don't have to see him anymore. I hated Billy Gillespie. It's not because I don't like Kentucky or anything like that. Billy Gillespie is just a jerk and an a-hole, and I can't stand him. And I made this comparison to someone else, maybe one of you guys. If you've seen Monsters Incorporated, I think I saw this on a plane. I'm not like a real big fan of these movies, but whatever the bad thing is, that little like lizard thing, I think it's purple. That's what Billy Gillespie looks like to me.
He actually changes color.
He's a shapeshifter.
No, he's like a chameleon. Who blends in with the surrounding.
Billy Gillespie was just a jerk. The way he treated the halftime reporters, her name from ESPN. He was terrible to her. I mean, and also. Some of the stories that came out on ESPN that he kicked a player off the bus, that he was verbally abusing Jody Meeks, told him not to come out for the second half of the game one time. He was the most selfish player he'd ever seen. I mean, Billy Gillespie was an idiot. And when you talk about, not only did they not have a great year, which is totally unacceptable at Kentucky, he could have bought himself more time by not being just totally clueless to his job. I mean, you're at one of the most visible jobs in college sports. And you have no class whatsoever. You don't know what you're doing. You don't want to relate to, like, boosters. You don't want to deal with the media. That just doesn't fly. That's all part of the job. And I couldn't be happy that he's gone.
My favorite thing was this. Like, after he got fired, people were asking, do you have any hard feelings? He said, no, I don't have any hard feelings. I just wish I won more games. That's nice to say after the fact.
I think the biggest problem with Gillespie is that he was a questionable hire to begin with at Kentucky. He was a relatively young head coach who had done pretty much nothing at Texas A&M until he got AC Law and made it to the Sweet 16 one year. And just based on the, two good years in the tournament, he was hired by Kentucky. But Calipari is a proven winner. He's won Conference USA 4 straight years, regular season and tournament. He won at UMass 5 years, the, what conference is that, the Atlantic Sun?
The A-10
conference. He won that 5 years in a row in the 90s. So Calipari is a winner who fits at Kentucky, whereas I don't think Gillespie did right away.
Yeah, that was a great hire for Kentucky. And I think a couple weeks ago we talked about what we thought Florida would do next year. And the question at the end was, will they be the best team in the SEC or the team to beat in the SEC?
Yeah.
I think that almost changes overnight with Kentucky. Especially like what Bob's about to tell you about some of the recruits that he might be able to pull with him to Kentucky.
How do you say? How do we decide his name was pronounced?
It's spelled Xavier. Kyle said Xavier, and Kyle knows his stuff, so we'll go with Xavier.
We'll go with Xavier.
It's Kyle's
Kyle first speaks French.
Yeah.
I'll call him Henry since that's his last name.
Let's go with that.
But him and also their other big one.
we can just call him.
DeMarcus Cousins. They both have those nice, you know, get out of jail free cards where they're Cousins hasn't actually signed the letter of intent, but you know, Henry can opt out to go somewhere else since the coach left. So he is not bound to, you know, Memphis at all.
To clarify really quickly, these were players that Calipari had recruited
to Memphis
and now that he's going to Kentucky.
They were both five stars. Henry is the number one shooting guard according to scout.com. And Cousins is the number two center. So they're big recruits.
Will either one of them follow him?
They both have said they're unsure. They haven't really talked to Calipari too much. They don't know who's going to be the coach in Memphis, so it might take a little while for them to decide where they're going. But they've already talked about it a little bit. Henry said he's willing to listen to Kansas, I believe, and also Kentucky. So he could be someone making that switch, and he's one of those players that everyone sees as a one-and-done type of guy. So he's a stud. Cousins, I believe, was talking to Washington and somewhere in
Kansas State, I thought.
Yeah, Kansas State. There you go. Thank you, Adam. So he's someone that could make a move as well, but it all depends on who Memphis brings in. But, yeah, the important part is that it's kind of too late for Calipari to bring in some of his own guys next year unless he can get one or both of those guys to come. So I don't think Kentucky makes a huge jump in the standings because they're still playing with Gillespie's guys because it's way too late in the game.
Yeah, and like we were talking about earlier, it's bad news for Florida that Calipari's coming in. This is going to make it really tough for Billy Donovan to recruit good players in the SEC East if he's going to have to go up against Kentucky. I mean, you look, they couldn't even get Patrick Patterson to come to Florida when he was boys with Jay Lucas, who was coming to Florida. With
and
Gillespie.
Who has since left Florida.
Right, who has since left. With Gillespie at Kentucky. And now with Calipari at Kentucky, it's going to be even harder to top them.
It could actually make it a little bit easier to recruit because while he's going up against Calipari, you got to think about it. You can only bring in 3-4 guys each class. Calipari is going to be talking about three point guards, three shooting guards, three small forwards, three power forwards, three centers, and they're only going to be taking one or two of those. So there's going to be leftover guys that Florida's probably going to be recruiting against Calipari with, and they could get the leftover 5-star, which, you know, it's nothing to.
But if Kentucky's getting the better players, then they're going to beat Florida, and that's the biggest thing for Florida.
They're considered the better player out of high school. Doesn't mean they're going to be the better player. I mean, if you get one of those top guys, you don't know which one of those top guys is going to be the better player. It's just who they think is the better player at that time.
But
so,
it's never good when you have a team. Give me this. It's never good when you have a team in your division who's going to have like the pick of the litter over you. And that's kind of what you're saying. It's true. They'll still be able to recruit. I mean, you still have Billy Donovan. I mean, it's not like you have a basketball tradition, but you have some trophies. you're in like a state with some good athletes. So they need to get the good Florida kids.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing for me with US. That's what they've got to do is get the Florida kids.
This is absolutely a great move for Kentucky all around. They're once again going to be a basketball powerhouse within, I'd say within 3 years they'll be in Final Fours. I think next year they could be a Sweet 16 team.
I mean, 2 years they're definitely back on top somewhere pretty close because, you know, Calipari is going to bring in the one-and-done type players that's going to make that huge impact right away. And, you know, the Derrick Rose type that's going to put your team close to the Final Four without much, you know, much else.
This is something I wanted to ask. Were any of us surprised that he took the job at all? Because, I mean,
no, I mean, I think if you're a big-time coach like Calipari is and you have aspirations to do great things, if a program like Kentucky comes calling, it's not like playing in the SEC is this great, you know, amazing thing, but playing in Conference USA, as much of a Conference USA fan as I am, that's a total joke. I mean, I grew up going to ECU basketball games, and I was there for a little while when they were playing Conference USA. It was awful. Oh, my gosh, it was terrible. But it's I can't say enough about how bad that is. So for Calipari, he got out, and that was very important. Although, he did leave a program with not a whole lot of pressure. I mean, he was going to walk to his conference championship, and I don't know what the fan base is like at Memphis, but they're certainly not as bad in terms of the pressure as the Kentucky fans are. That's the only downside.
My point was that he's a year out of the national championship game. You know, he's building a program there. Why, you know, you're not surprised by that at all, that he just turned tail and left?
Well, like what Bobby said, if he's getting, if he's recruiting a lot of one-and-done type players, you don't have the kind of, see, the players that make you stay are the guys who are like Tim Tebow, maybe even like a Nick Calathes type guy, where you have like, it's not, they don't have as strong of a bond, actually, Donovan Calathes, as you would think, but those kind of guys that, that you know are going to be there for the long haul and that you talk to, if you've got a lot of guys who are just coming in and this is their stop on the way to the NBA, it's different.
Like the 06s, yeah, they left early, but they came back a whole nother year. That type of, you know, bond that like they had with Billy was what coaches stay for. That's what makes them want to stay. I mean, as much as Calipari was the Memphis coach and associated with Memphis, it wasn't like he's, you know, Memphis basketball.
He's not like the Memphis man or anything. Like you wouldn't like automatically associate Calipari and Memphis like forever.
Another reason that I'm not surprised he took the job, besides the fact that it's Kentucky and it's a huge name, is the money. Did anyone see how many zeros are at the end of his contract? He's now the highest paid coach in the country, highest paid college men's basketball coach in the country. So as much as people like to say it's not about the money,
nah,
I'd like to see any one of us turn down like $75 million over 8 years or whatever the ridiculous contract was.
Do you remember how much Gillespie got when he went there?
No.
I remember
less than that.
A ridiculous amount for that type of coach.
Oh, here's something interesting I wanted to say earlier about Gillespie. There's no way this is going to happen, but somebody threw this around. I thought it would be funny. Georgia's looking for a coach.
Oh, wow.
And someone said, oh, yeah, Gillespie's probably going to take the Georgia job and work for like $500,000 since he'll be living off the money Kentucky owes him. Now, that would... I would still hate Gillespie, but I would love him for that. If he would go to another school in the division, can you still take Kentucky's money if you take a job?
I don't know the clauses, but I assume that he can go anywhere he wants because it's not like he resigned or he quit. He was fired. So
right.
The pressure's all on Kentucky. Also, Georgia, you brought up Georgia's coach. I know they were trying to get Mike Anderson. I think it's Mike Anderson from Missouri.
Yeah, he re-signed with Missouri.
Yeah, he re-signed. But I was actually kind of surprised that they were going after someone, you know, who's coming off such a great year at Missouri and that high profile of a guy. So apparently Georgia is setting their target pretty high.
I agree with Mike that I love the idea of Gillespie coming to Georgia, which would, of course, make things even more bad for Florida, even worse for Florida, with another huge name coach coming to the – coming into the conference and staying with the conference in the division, the SEC East. And Georgia was a joke of a program last year, so anyone they can get would be better. But if they got someone like Gillespie, that'd be huge for them and bad for Florida.
And the Anthony Grant hire, does that mean anything for them?
Anthony Grant was a big deal just for the conference as a whole. He isn't going to hurt Florida as directly as Calipari and Kentucky will, but he has the name recognition. He's been in the tournament for the last 2 years with Virginia Commonwealth. And like I said, he knows the recruits that Billy Donovan is going to go after. He has a base in Florida. So I can see him hurting Florida off the court more than he will on the court because they're not in the same division of the conference.
Yeah, Anthony Grant has been a good coach. People probably are confused with Virginia Commonwealth. They probably more know him as VCU.
Yes.
So like just hearing VCU, they're going to like think of Anthony Grant because he really brought that team, you know, to a high level in the last couple of years. I think right away he can actually make a difference at Alabama because he's a very good coach and he's a good recruiter. He proved that there. And I'm pretty sure at Florida, he was Florida's big guy for recruiting.
Yeah.
Why? So he knows how to recruit. He'll bring in good players. So I think Alabama's another team that is going to improve very fast.
Is it also bad for Florida that do you think that if Billy Donovan were to leave in the next two seasons, is Anthony Grant less likely to come to Florida after 2 years at Alabama, a bigger program? Even though Alabama isn't like a great basketball school, is that hard? Is that bad news for Florida?
I think it is, in the sense that Anthony Grant doesn't want to constantly move around. You know, he spent his time in Florida, then he moved to Virginia Commonwealth, VCU, excuse me, Bobby, VCU.
Thank you.
Sorry for using the full name. He moved to VCU for 2 years, you know, all the way up from Gainesville to Virginia, and then he goes back down to Tuscaloosa. I don't think he wants to continually uproot himself so much as that, and he will be building a program in Alabama, and you kind of want to see the fruit of your labor.
I mean, that's true, but in coaching world, you want to keep going up and up the ladder. And if Alabama, you know, after 2 years is still around where they are, even if they've gotten just a little better, and Florida stays where they are, Florida's still ahead of them. They're still, you know, another step on that ladder and can keep going up and keep going up until he finally gets, you know, an NBA job. So that's the end goal for a coach is to, you know, make it to professional leagues for, you know, for most of them. So I see him, if Florida comes calling for him and Florida's not like in the gutter and Alabama's on top of the SEC, for him to make that jump.
Right, and the point I was trying to make isn't that, you know, McCall's question was, is he less likely to come to Gainesville if he builds a program in Alabama? And my answer is yes. I'm not saying he's going to turn down the Gators just on principle, but because he's at Alabama and building his own program, I think he is less likely to come to Gainesville than he would have been if he was at VCU for 4 years.
Now, the real question is, how do you think Shaka Smart's going to do at VCU?
Yes, also, small note there, UF men's basketball assistant coach Shaka Smart is replacing Anthony Grant at VCU. And so Billy Donovan has to replace a member of his staff for, what, the third straight year now? He has to go to someone else.
The big question is, I want to know where the connection is between VCU and UF. Because there's got to be some guy that just, like, that's connected with UF somewhere and be like, hey, you know, can we get your coach? Because it just seems that they need a new coach, go to UF. And it's not like UF is known for having great assistant coaches.
I'm assuming Grant and Smart know each other, probably. I mean, Grant probably dropped some hints along the way.
Yeah, they have to at some level know each other.
So you would think the connection's in there somewhere, then.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how all this pans out, especially when Donovan... I mean, Donovan's got, what, how many more years before he's allowed to go back to the NBA if he wants to? Is it three more years?
Three more years.
Something in that area.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens if he decides to go running to the NBA. What happens then?
I don't think he's wanted in the NBA. One, I mean, what he did to the Magic, a lot of teams are very, like, turned off by. And two, he was at the peak of, you know, his coaching career 2 years ago, where everyone wanted Billy Donovan. He just came off two national championships. No one wants a, you know, right now, someone who's got a mediocre program in college. No one wants that. So unless he wins another championship in these next 3 years, I don't think he's wanted in the NBA.
Yeah, that point is very well taken, because Billy Donovan could have gone to any number of NBA teams after the 2007 national championship game. But now I think, you know, he would almost be betraying Florida if he left so soon again, because he was, you know, at the top of his career, he had nowhere else to go in the college basketball world. He won his two national championships, try out the NBA. But now, after, you know, losing for 2 years in college ranks, for him to go against his, I love Florida so much and I made a mistake going in Orlando and this is where I want to be, for him to go against that and go elsewhere to the NBA, I think he'd be betraying the fans.
Especially since Orlando was the perfect job for him, because it was a very young team on the uprise, and it wasn't like he was uprooting his family and moving them so far away. His family could have stayed in Gainesville. It's only like an hour and 45-minute drive to Orlando. So it's not even like, you know, that was the reason.
If you're making the kind of money Billy Donovan would be making, it's more like a 15-minute plane ride.
All right, and we're going to move on here into our final segment. We're going to talk a little about the final four here. We're going to first plug our bracket challenge, maybe for the last time. Go to our site, see how you're doing. I'm not doing well. I have not been doing well since the Elite Eight. Let's go around the table here, see how we're doing. McCall?
Yeah, I'm the champ of the room right now. I'm in third place. One of our writers, Chris Yazbek, is in second, and then I think it was the team named Red Saber. First. Unfortunately, Red Saber also went the correct route, as did I, in picking UNC is the national champion, so I can't win. The best I can do is come in second after the Heels win.
Yeah, don't count your chickens there. Watch out for UConn. But, I am the one you all have to beat, and I'm in 23rd place right now, which is decent, but the problem for me is that I have no more possible points remaining. My championship game was Pitt-Memphis, and Memphis lost in the Sweet 16, and Pitt lost in the Elite Eight.
So it's not decent, basically. Is what
no, my standing is currently decent, but after Saturday's games, there will be about 50 people vaulted ahead of me.
Standing is decent. Bracket, maybe not so much. A little closer to mine.
So this is good news for all of you out there who are interested in winning the prize, which I guess is important to you. So yeah, you guys are in good shape.
Bobby?
My bracket looks messy, but I had UNC as the champion, and I got two Final Four teams. So right now, I considered it still a success until UNC gets knocked out, which hopefully they don't. I hate to say that because McCall's over there just smiling like a little child. Hopefully they actually do it, and I'm up. I think that puts it four in a row for me.
It's worth noting, though, that the points are worth a whole lot more here in these last couple rounds, so anything could happen except for me advancing because I have no Final Four teams left, so congratulations to all of you who picked better than me. It was not much of a challenge, to be fair. So do we want to talk a little about the Final Four here?
I've got to say that for me in the bracket pools this year, the greatest thing that has happened in this college basketball season for me is Ty Lawson hurting his toe.
Because Kyle sent everyone
running away from UNC.
Myself included.
Several people in here, Kyle also did that. And I mean, if you look at UNC, they're pulling future NBA players off the bench. UNC's awesome. They really, and I'm not just saying this because I like UNC. UNC's really good. I think anyone here would say that. And I mean, Louisville wasn't a great half-court team. They couldn't shoot free throws. That was their undoing.
Same with Memphis.
Memphis plays in Conference USA. Pitt was. I never was that high on Pitt. I mean, they were good at times. I mean, I like Connecticut. I really do. I think Connecticut's good. If anyone was going to beat UNC, I think it would have been Connecticut, and that's why I put them in the championship game against UNC. But thank you, Ty Lawson, for hurting your toe and then coming back and being the little baller that you are.
For the record, the night before the first game started, I was talking to Kyle, and I'm like, I'm so nervous about Ty Lawson. Like, I'm worried that his toe's going to be really bad. He's not going to be the same type of player. He's not going to play enough. Like, I want to change it. He's like, no, you shouldn't change it. You're set. Like, Ty Lawson's going to be okay. I'm like, all right, fine. Like, I won't change it. And of course, I find out the next day he panicked and changed it. So I feel as though I might have had something to do with him changing his bracket.
Yeah, Kyle woke up in the middle of the night and changed his, as did I. I think we both woke up in a panic. Me, because I had UCLA in the Final Four.
Wow. That would have been dumb.
Which was bad.
Close call.
I changed it to Villanova, which worked out pretty well. So that was a nice change. But those middle of the night things are a tricky thing. I was hating myself for the next day. I was like, oh, I should have left UCLA. Like, I would have looked like a genius when they did it. But, I mean, you never know. It's hard to decide whether to go with your first feeling or your gut or whatever.
So, obviously, you have UNC winning it. So, who do you think they're going to play?
I think Connecticut. I mean, that's what I thought from day one. So
I agree.
I'm going to stick with that. Although Michigan State keeps crashing the party, so I mean, we'll see what happens with that.
I'm sure most people around the country right now with the current Final Four are expecting a Connecticut-North Carolina Final Four, championship game. But I would not be surprised if Michigan State did something crazy.
Besides Michigan State fans, everyone's praying that it's UConn and UNC. They're still hoping that they can salvage a good championship game.
I mean, Michigan State is not a bad team. They put up a fight against it. Really, but I mean, you're going to listen. At this point, you're going to get a bad championship game because UNC is going to win. UNC is going to win handily. So I'm sorry. I apologize to everyone out there. Find something else to do Monday night because you're not going to be watching a good basketball game.
All right. Mike McCall has spoken. So we're going to move on here into our little weekly segment, the Reggie Nelson Awards for Excellence in the Field of Sport and the Kyle Jackson Bad Angles of the Week. The Reggies obviously go to somebody in the field of sport who we, you know, we like what they did in the week, and Kyle Jackson we did not like so much. So let's start with McCall. Who's your Reggie?
Yeah, my Reggie's going to go to Scotty Reynolds of Villanova. I thought from the beginning of the tournament the Pitt was going to go down. I had them losing to Xavier in the Elite Eight, or I'm sorry, in the Sweet 16, which they should have lost. Xavier was up in the final minute, and they blew that, threw a pass away, LeVance Field took it down and made a layup. So I really thought Pitt should have lost before then. I needed them to for my bracket. I needed Nova in the Final Four. Scotty Reynolds delivered going coast to coast with the game-winning layup. So that was great. He gets my Reggie. For my Kyle Jackson, unfortunately, I'm going to have to give it to myself. yesterday, I'm ashamed to admit this, yesterday I was playing racquetball. I was in the back corner of the court, and I totally messed up my ankle. I don't know what I did. I sprained it. It totally buckled under me. I crumpled to the floor. Game over. I've been limping around ever since, and my foot has swollen up to an unbelievable level. So I'm in huge discomfort. It was one of the most awkward and unathletic things I've ever done. So I'm going to have to begrudgingly take the Kyle Jackson this week. No one performed worse than I did last week.
All right, Evan.
All right, get ready to groan, everybody in the room. But my Reggie Nelson Award for Excellence in the Field of Sport goes to Detroit Red Wings forwards Johan Franzen and Marian Hossa, who have said in the last couple weeks that they will be willing to take less money to re-sign with the Red Wings because the salary cap is going to be an issue this year because Hossa accepted such a huge deal to come to the Red Wings this year. And Franzen is an up-and-coming star who would require a big deal. And especially since they signed Henrik Zetterberg to a ridiculous 13-year deal in the middle of the season, they're hurting for money. So Franzen and Hossa, two stars, saying that they're going to accept smaller deals to come back with the Red Wings and win some more titles. That gets the Reggie Nelson Award for me.
Yeah, you know, very nice, Evan. I'm normally not a proponent of hockey talk, but I'm a big fan of anyone who takes a pay cut to do anything. Yeah. So I got to give him credit for that. I don't know about those other weird names you were throwing out there.
I'm just a little upset that no one's actually going to hear mine because they all stop listening when you start talking.
I know. I was so used to just, you know, when Evan starts talking Red Wings, my finger goes toward the stop button there. So, I mean, but that is noble,
yeah,
I will say.
But yeah, I the general sentiment of an athlete taking less money to stay
absolutely
with a team that he feels devoted to and will win. And the same with the coach to resign. Anyone who's going to take less money to stay at home is honorable in that sense.
Anybody who shows commitment like that,
yes,
just at all.
Because you're almost never going to see someone like, you know, who I grew up with, Dan Marino, staying with one team the whole career. You know, that's so rare nowadays. Anyway, back on track, my Kyle Jackson goes to Mother Nature, who destroyed some UF athletics this week. Baseball game got canceled, and our baseball writers were not notified until very late. They almost went to the game, caused some fly ball mishaps, and also caused the FSU relays, the track and field meet, to get shortened. So it was just Mother Nature rained out some athletics, and that's never fun to see stuff get canceled and postponed.
It also wrecks the Florida State game in Jacksonville on Tuesday, which
baseball
me, Kyle,
game.
And Bobby were all
right
there. It got stopped after the fifth inning. Jack Posey, Buster's brother, Buster Posey being the god of baseball, Jack hit a solo home run in the top of the fifth to put FSU up 3-2. Then UF hit a line drive up the middle. Jericho Weitzel got doubled off at second base. That was it. Then they went into a lightning delay. Then it got rained out. That was really lame because that game, if you've never been to that, next year you've got to go see the baseball grounds of Jacksonville. I mean, this year I think it was 6,000. It was kind of rainy. The year I went in 2006, there were 12,000, which I don't expect that to happen again unless they're both awesome. But it's a really fun atmosphere, and, yeah, Mother Nature killed it.
That's absolutely the most fun game of the UF baseball season. I was there last year, and there weren't quite 12,000, but it was in the 9,500s, I believe. So that game was, you know, you get the real rivalry, kind of like the Florida-Georgia thing in Jacksonville. You just get to see a good time and a good baseball game, and it's just a shame that Mother Nature had to rear her ugly head and stop the game after five innings.
All right, Bobby.
I'm going to start with my Kyle Jackson because I too put the rain because...
Oh, did you? I'm sorry.
Oh, man.
All year leading up for Wilds Covered Baseball, McCollum and Evan, all they could talk about is how great the Florida UF game at Jacksonville is, how much like fun you're going to have, how the atmosphere is so great compared to regular games. So, you know, all the hype came in. I went there. I was excited to watch it. It was a 3-2 game, and I only get five innings of baseball. Plus, interviews were really messy, so it was tougher to do interviews after the game. So that really ruined my day. My Reggie Nelson goes to Kentucky for bringing in John Calipari.
Well, that's pretty easy.
Yeah, it's short and sweet. All right, and I guess I'll round it out here. I'm going to give my Reggie Nelson award to Chad Engerhofer. Certainly not a name most people are familiar with, but he is the PA guy for the softball team here at UF. After one of the games last weekend, after Florida beat Alabama in the doubleheader last Saturday, Walton went off on this weird rant in his post-game interviews where he thanked the PA guy, Chad, you know, for most of the team's success. He said he's just as good as his team is, the number one team in the country. And then Chad had a great reaction to that the next day, you know, in the press box. He went around screaming that he was the number one PA guy in the nation. He texted me asking for the audio clip. Just a good guy, though. I mean, he is really good at what he does. So, giving my Reggie to Chad Engerhofer. Good job, Chad. Also, that blog post I wrote about it has gotten more comments than any stories I've written combined. Four comments more than any of my stories
That's
I've ever
impressive.
Gotten combined. One blog about a PA guy. I'm just throwing that out there. And my Kyle Jackson bad angle is going to go to the Chicago Bears for taking Jay Cutler and just throwing away a ton of stuff for him. McCall, you were talking about that earlier.
Wait, hold on one second. The Chicago Bears got Jay Cutler?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Breaking news.
I stopped watching SportsCenter at like 2 p.m. today. When did this happen?
Yeah, I guess later on in the afternoon. But the Bears are giving up two first-round picks, and is it a third-round pick?
I believe
and
it is,
Kyle
yeah.
Orton.
Yeah.
Not like, I mean, whatever, Kyle Orton, but... They're
like that, Kyle Orton.
Whatever, Kyle Orton.
There are very few people who are worth two first-round draft picks. And also, I'm a big fan of third-round draft picks, too. I think you get a lot of like unheralded, under-the-radar guys there that can really blossom. Second round also a little bit. But two first-round picks? That's outrageous. I don't know what's more outrageous. That or the Patriots giving up Matt Castle and Vrabel for just one second-round pick. That's... Both of those are atrocious to me.
Well, I think with the way the Bears draft, it doesn't really matter that much.
Yeah.
The Bears are just going to
waste two
picks.
I agree. Two first-round draft picks for Jay Cutler, a bit ridiculous. But you got to remember, they've had to deal with Kyle Warden, Rex Grossman, insert random quarterback here for the last 4 years. They just want someone who's good. And Jay Cutler is a good quarterback in the NFL.
Yeah.
So they were willing to give away a lot of things to actually get a quarterback who can, help out that defense for, just a little bit.
I think if you're going to trade two first-round picks for any quarterback, Jay Cutler is going to be on the top of the list just because he's still young and is, has the potential to be one of the best. I mean, you're not going to get Tom Brady from the Patriots. You're not going to get Peyton Manning from the Colts. So, I mean, if there's anyone you're going to give away two first-round picks for, I think Cutler's a good one.
But also with the trouble with the Broncos, Cutler wasn't happy. He wanted a trade. That seems like that'd be leverage if you're trying to get Cutler. You know they have to get rid of him.
Yeah.
You don't have to overspend to get him. It just seems like maybe like what Bob's saying, they're desperate to get a quarterback. They saw one they wanted, so they just jumped out and just threw everything they had at it. That just seemed excessive. I mean, I wonder if that was like the first offer that was put out there, or if the Bears had to be like talked up or down from that.
I mean, even if it's not the first offer, the Broncos see that and they go, yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, exactly.
You would think that other teams would have the leverage until there were so many teams that wanted Jay Cutler. The Redskins, who actually have a good quarterback in Jason Campbell, was getting involved in talks. So the Bears figured, if we want a quarterback, you know, without having a draft or I guess use Kyle Orton, as high as that is again, that we better actually give them a offer that they can't refuse and stop trying to compete with these other teams.
Part of the reason I'm giving the Bears my Kyle Jackson is because I secretly wanted the Bucks to get Jay Cutler. The Bucks, my favorite NFL team. And we're going to once again give a show-wide Kyle Jackson bad angle of the week to Mr. Phil Kegler.
Two weeks in a row for Phil.
2 weeks in a row getting the Kyle Jackson for, once again, not showing up. So thanks, Phil. We appreciate that.
We hope you're listening.
We know he's not, though. I mean, we'd say this even if he was, but let's be honest. Phil's not listening.
We just hope that anyone who is listening points and laughs at Phil when they see him in public.
Just send him an email, pkegler@alligator.org. let him know you missed his contributions tonight.
Speaking of emails, great segue, Evan. I have an email here from our loyal listener, Vince Faniola. Just great email. I got it once again while I was in class. It just cracked me up. He was talking about the Tebow out of control hype scenario, and he said he had no scenarios for us, but he has this. If Tim Tebow managed to get Florida another national championship, he will name his firstborn Tim Tebow Faniola for a boy or Percy Meyer Tebow Faniola for a girl. And then this is the best part of the email by far. He says, you may think I'm joking, but my fiance is tiny, and when she gives birth, she will be so heavily sedated that I could name the kid Frosted Flakes, and she wouldn't find out for at least 2 days. Great email, Vince. We really appreciate
that.
Keep them coming. Everybody else out there, send emails to sports@alligator.org, and much like Vince's, we will read them on the show. And I guess that about wraps it up for today. So thanks for listening.
Good night, Vince.
I don't even have to interrupt with Red Wings talk today. We already got it.
Like right now, we're out.